This is
the Epilogue Audio Experience.
And all that jazz. Welcome to the artists. As Godard said, you don't make a movie, the movie makes you. In our movie-making profession, the workings of Murphy's Law is always at its best. In these candid conversations, we unravel those challenges that define the makers in the movie-making business. Hope these chats will inspire and elevate you to keep fighting for your dreams, but with a mode of reality check on it. I'm your host, Suchita, and this podcast is brought to you by Metaphysical Lab. Enjoy the show. Hello guys, welcome to our episode number 40th of our podcast, The Artists. And of course, we all know about the global film festival that's on right now. We are one, and I hope you guys are watching. It starts from today, 30th of May, and goes until 7th of June. And I've got some recommendations from one of our guests, Maya Kurbeka. She's in episode 30th of the podcast. And she says, go watch Mary is Happy. Go watch Nasir. Go watch City Called Macau. Go watch Sisterhood. Go watch animations from Anisi. And I've got more recommendations, one being Ibale U, which I was any which way is going to watch it because we've got the producer of the film on our podcast, episode number 27, so go check that out. And besides that, of course, I'm going to do some random digging without recommendations, which I think even you guys can go ahead and watch. So that brings us to the guest of today. Yes, guys, we have with us Mr. Subhash Kak. Now, this is going to be a long introduction of Mr. Kak for the amount of work that he has done. Mr. Subhash Kak is a Regents Professor at the Oklahoma State University. He has made fundamental contributions to the neural networks, information science, and quantum theory. He was the first to come up with the idea of quantum neural computing, and he has proposed that the brain has three languages, associative, reorganizational, and quantum. Apart from the technical work, he has written on Indian science, yoga, and art. His resolution of the twin paradox of relativity theory and work on Indian archaeoastronomy has received considerable attention in the popular press. He has shown that ancient Indians were aware that the sun and the moon are approximately 108 times their respective diameters from the earth. He has also authored 6 books of verse. And I'm reading this from Chopra.com, which is part of Mr. Deepak Chopra's initiative. And we of course know who is Mr. Deepak Chopra. And besides this, Mr. Kak has been a member of the Prime Minister of India's Science, Technology and Innovation Advisory Council since 2018. Hi, Subhash. Welcome to our podcast, The Artist. And thank you for taking our time and being part of the show. And just to begin the conversation, when I had sent you this mail across a couple of weeks back, you mentioned that you were traveling across US. So how's the lockdown going out there?
Suchita, great to be connected and having this conversation. We came back from Miami where we were staying for a few weeks, 2 days ago.
Sure.
And the lockdown in the US is somewhat different from what the reports of how it's being done in India are. For example, people do walk in the streets, and in Miami, we would take walks, long walks, both in the morning and evening. The grocery stores are open, and there are cars on the highways, so people do go from one place to another.
Okay, so it's pretty much under control. So,
right.
So sir, I came across your wonderful and insightful articles on Medium, and of course your papers, which are mentioned on your Twitter handle as well. So this point that you mentioned in one of your articles, one of your essays, write-ups, was about Ramanujam, about how he used to solve his creative problems in his dreams. And a lot of scientists and artists have also claimed to have got flashes of the problem solvings in their dreams. Even Einstein mentioned that. What is here at play, sir?
Well, the question of how creativity occurs is a complicated one from the perspective of psychology or from the perspective of reasoning. Mm-hmm. Because one would like to believe, and this is generally what people are led to believe when they are studying in school or college, mm-hmm. that all of reasoning is incremental. You have information and somehow you work on that information and you arrive at new results. Mm-hmm. But when you speak to artists, mm-hmm. or when you speak to mathematicians, for example, there is this very famous book by the French mathematician named Jacques Hadamard. Mm-hmm. What he did was he wrote to the leading mathematicians of his times and asked them how had they arrived at their discovery. And a vast majority of the responses was that this discovery happened spontaneously, or we were dreaming, or we were just walking across, and then suddenly in a flash we made this discovery. So it appears that creativity across many different disciplines is not a next step from within the box mm-hmm. of the information or knowledge that you have, but rather an outside of the box view of what you knew before. So it is somewhat dramatic. And my own experience in my own research, both scientific and historical, is that my most important discoveries, if you will, were rather spontaneous.
Right. And how would you also define the aspects of consciousness in this?
Okay, but before I add to that, you had asked me about Ramanujan. Ramanujan came up with all these amazing formulas, and mathematicians are still working on it because he died very young. I believe he was 32,
yeah.
And he spent his last year or two in a sanatorium. And then while he was there, he had scribbled these notebooks, which were lost for about 70 years, or mm-hmm. 60, 70 years. Mm-hmm. And when they were discovered, I think it was in the 70s, mathematicians discovered that he had formulas or results for which there was no context. Because, you know, when I said discoveries, normally, the understanding would be that there is a context, you look at some existing results and then you go beyond it.
Hmm.
But a lot of these results had no context, and they've been working on for a long time, and they have found that these results are generally true or mostly true. Now, Ramanujan himself used to claim, when he was asked by Hardy and others, how do you get these formulas because you can't explain how you have them?
Hmm.
He would say that, look, in my dream, the goddess Namagiri or Namakkal comes and she writes on a screen and I just memorize it, and when I wake up, I write the formulas down. Now, there are two ways of looking at this statement. One is that it's literally true. The other is that it's a poetic expression of the belief that somehow there was a process which you then express in this image, where there's a process that suddenly to you a certain discovery was made clear in your mind's eye.
Mm-hmm.
So now, how does consciousness work? Hmm. Now, this brings us to the question, what is consciousness?
Yes.
Now, normally in psychology, we speak of the mind. And mind is the inner faculty which lets us recall memories and do reasoning and make judgments, moral or otherwise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Indian thought, mind is also called antahkaran, which means the inner instrument,
mm-hmm.
but it's really being actualized by consciousness. Consciousness or Atman,
mm-hmm.
In Sanskrit, is what is behind the mind, And in its normal workings, the mind is like a machine. It's like a computer.
Mm-hmm.
But from time to time, one is able to go beyond the framework of this inner computer.
Mm-hmm.
Because if mind were nothing but a computer, then you will have to accept the proposition that eventually computers will be able to do all that minds do,
mm-hmm.
and therefore AI machines, which will eventually become conscious.
Yes. Hmm. Yeah. And so you have a very interesting paper that you've also written on it, which is on Medium.
Right. And in fact, this is one of the biggest debates going on in science at the frontiers of many different disciplines, such as computer science, because, well, will machines ever become conscious? In neuroscience, because the question then is, where does the subject reside within the brain?
Hmm.
The brain is also a machine.
It's
a neural machine.
Hmm.
But is there a specific correlate of consciousness? And neuroscientists have been unable to find such a specific correlate. In other words, different parts of the brain light up based on what kind of cognitions are being done. There is no unique part of the brain which lights up. And then in physics also, because physics, as you know, in quantum mechanics, you have the object and you have the observer. You have the system and you have the observer.
Hmm.
So the observer is always outside of the physical system. Even in Newtonian physics, the observer is outside. You imagine it is a system, it is an object, it's moving at a certain speed and so on. And you're always looking at it from the outside. But now, in quantum mechanics, the way you interact with it does have an influence on the object, which is why you have the uncertainty relation, you know, the famous Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have the idea that, and this is the orthodox interpretation of quantum mechanics, that the observer is always apart from the physical system. In other words, there is a split. There is the physical universe and there is the universe of consciousness, which is perfectly consistent with Vedanta. In fact, one of the creators of quantum mechanics, an Austrian physicist named Erwin Schrödinger, he was a Vedantin and he used to travel wherever carrying the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads with him.
Mm.
He claimed in his autobiography that the central idea of quantum mechanics came to him from the Upanishads.
Mm-hmm.
In the Upanishads, you have a Mahavakya, or one of those great statements, which says, I am Atma Brahma, which means that this Atman is Brahman. Brahman means the entire universe.
Mm-hmm.
And Atman is the self. And this is, of course, counterintuitive. How can the one be the all? Right? Atman is equal to Brahman means one, meaning you or I have access to the entire universe. And this is the central idea of quantum mechanics, because in that field, it's believed that, it's not believed, it's a part of the theory, that all kinds of mutually exclusive states exist in a superposition as one. And then when you interact with the system, you get access to one of those. You can't access all of them because the mind is classical, because the mind is like a computer. It can hold on to only one. But reality is multiplicative, or it is in parallel. There are so many things happening in parallel, as in this conception of quantum mechanics, or as is a fundamental part of Vedanta or the Vedas.
Sure. So when it comes to Vedanta, its relation to and its understanding and its definition of consciousness versus in the Siva Sutra, which was 1200 years old, which has mentioned the mystery of consciousness with reference to free will. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Sure. First of all, you go back to the Vedas itself. You know,
so Siva Sutra, Siva Sutra is a was a part of Vedas or?
No, no. The Vedas are very ancient, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years old or even older.
Okay.
And the oldest of them is the Rig Veda, which has 1,017 hymns and all that. And then the explanation of the Vedas is given in the Upanishads, which are in very straightforward dialogue, so it's easy to comprehend them. And in the Upanishads, it's stated that there are two kinds of knowledge. One is the knowledge of the outer world, which is called Apara Vidya, and the knowledge of the self. The self here means Atman or Atma, and or it means the observer, or it means the consciousness. So there is the outer knowledge, for which you need language, for which you need mathematics, and all the stuff that you learn in the university is outer knowledge. But the inner knowledge cannot be described in terms of language because it is experiential.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, Vedanta is one of many different ways of looking at this knowledge, because you also have other darshanas, and darshan means seeing, such as Purva Mimamsa or Nyaya means logic, or Vaisheshika, which means physics, or Yoga is also a darshan, or Sankhya. Sankhya is describing reality in terms of different categories. And finally, Vedanta. Vedanta is a way of looking at reality in an overarching manner. And what Vedanta then says, and it's consistent or complementary to the other darshanas, what Vedanta says is that superficially, you have the physical reality and then you have yourself, right? But beyond it, at a higher level of description, they are one. And there is this whole system of the physical universe emerging from the its ground stuff, which is consciousness. So consciousness is the deepest reality. Now, later on, what happened was that this was described variously. And since we already mentioned Atman is equal to Brahman, and you have consciousness also within you, right?
Yes.
And this consciousness is one, so your consciousness and my consciousness is the same,
yes.
Although your mind and my mind are different because your life experience is different from my life experience. But our consciousness is the same, and this consciousness was given the name Shiva or Ishvara. Ishvara is the name, one of the names of consciousness. There are many different names. And therefore, the claim is that when you, you know, the person who really enjoys anything is Ishwar. And why? Because the mind is like a machine, and a machine cannot enjoy anything. So the real entity who is your true being is the is Shiva within you. Now, about 1300-1400 years ago, now the Shiva or Shaivite tradition is a very ancient one, but there was one of the sages in Kashmir. He wrote these Shiva Sutras, who spoke of this mystery of mind and consciousness in a reformulated way, with great clarity, but it's a part of the larger Vedanta system. It's not different from Vedanta. The manner in which some people view Kashmir Shaivism as being different from Vedanta, such as Shankaracharya's Vedanta, which is of course very, very influential, is that Shankaracharya speaks of that the world is sort of an illusion, that it's a kind of a mithya. Hmm. Now, in Kashmir Shaivism, what is stated is that the world is also an embodiment of deity or of Shiva. You know, you have the subject within you who is Shiva in each individual, in every sentient being. We're all the same. But then you have the physical embodied universe that is not to be, now that's not permanent, because anything that is embodied has a lifespan, and it's in that sense that it's mithya. You know, you have the famous invocations that all Indians and non-Indians, also non-Indians in Western universities, because they also are taught this, that Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya, right?
Yeah.
From if death take me to immortality. What that really means is, from the identity that we normally have, that we are just the physical body, take us to the sense that we are the immortal Atman which is within us. That we may want to call Shiva, or if your temperament or your context is different, you might want to call self as Vishnu or Krishna or the goddess. So you can use different images, because the images are all linguistic, and images are only some kind of a shadow, because the true experience of consciousness cannot be communicated. All that it does, it enlivens your mind, it changes you. And to that extent, each time it changes you, you're sort of reborn. That is the whole idea of punarjanma, which takes place in many different ways within your own life.
Sure.
So you can look at reincarnation across lives, but also within your life, where you let go of who you thought you were before and become a new person.
Sure. And so this consciousness is different in every person. What does it depend on? What does it depend on that I am at this level of consciousness and you are in another level of consciousness?
Consciousness is one. And now you might say, how could it be one? You're sitting in Mumbai, I'm sitting here in the US, right? Consciousness is not material. It's not a consequence of what is going on in your brain circuits. Consciousness is something which transcends, which means it's at a plane above that of the matter, time, space complex.
Yes.
So it's at a different plane. So it's transcendental. But it's also, it's like, you know, you could say, you have electromagnetic waves everywhere. The very fact that we are talking, you are in Mumbai, I'm here in the US, and we are able to communicate with each other,
is
because these waves envelop the entire globe.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Now, but these waves also are related to matter. You know, you can generate the waves from matter. While the idea of consciousness is even more revolutionary, that consciousness does not emerge from matter, but it enlivens matter. In other words, look at your brain. If you're sleeping, you're not conscious, right?
Yes.
Or you could be groggy.
Yeah.
Groggy, your consciousness is not very clear.
Yes.
So, but your the consciousness that you have is not. Step back for a moment. It's consciousness which is captured differently based on what your brain states are.
Yes.
So if somebody were to unfortunately have an accident and injure part of his brain, then that individual's consciousness would be limited in a variety of ways, because in some sense, his brain apparatus would not be able to deal with all that consciousness can provide us.
Sure, sir. So there is this Tibetan Buddhism, the book that I recently sort of got, where it mentions about the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth bend of consciousness. And it says that how can you attain the sixth bend of consciousness, wherein your sort of a focus, your awareness, your attention is like unwavering. So, sir, is it like a relation of consciousness to your concentration and your awareness and your attention?
Oh, absolutely. If you do Yoga Sutras, for example, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra,
yes.
Right, which is this great manual of yoga, the yoga movement, which is sort of conquered the entire globe right now. You go to any country of the world, you'll see yoga studios in any city, in any country, the remotest places where people travel, you'll find yoga studios. Even in places like Iran and Saudi Arabia, you'll be surprised. There are women doing yoga. Of course, in some countries, in very traditional countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia, they have introduced yoga more from the perspective of asanas, you know, so that you can be in better health and so on. But the people who have introduced it there, and they all come to Rishikesh, or they have their gurus in India, they are quite aware that asanas are only one step to eventually going from the body to the mind and finally to consciousness. Because you have here this idea of five koshas, that you have what is called the annamaya kosha, which means the kosha of the food, which is your physical body. Then you have the pranamaya kosha, which is of the various pranas. You have five pranas, the breath.
Yes.
Firstly, of course, the actual breath that you take.
Mm.
Then you have manomaya kosha, which is your mind. And then you have Vijnanamaya Kosha, and then Anandamaya Kosha. And beyond that lies the Atma. So the whole idea then is that based on how much of concentration, which is what's called Dharana and Dhyana in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, right? How much of concentration you have, you can take in an idea or a narrative and go to the very heart of it and can do other things. And not only can you do other things related to the contents of that narrative, but if you really had, if you can really do samadhi, then you can even step back and go outside of the box. And that's when creative act occurs. And therefore, all of this, all of yoga, all of these practices of concentration are a means for you to go from ordinary modes, which are driven mainly by instinct, you know, like that of animals, like that of your pets. We are not really very different from our pets. Normally, you know, the pet also, you have a dog, gets up, does its business, has emotional relationship with everybody in your house and sleeps and so on. This is what our life is also most of the time. Excepting from time to time, if we so strive, we are able to step out of this whole straitjacket of sleeping and waking, which in the Shaiva tradition, what is described as our normal Pashu life, and our Pashu life is because of Pasha or binding. Pash means bind, or bandhan. Pashas to our nature, which is to the nature of our mind. And if we let go and get connected to Pashupati within us, Pashupati is another name for Shiva.
Yeah.
That's when you obtain freedom. Because normally we are not free. Our dog is not free because our dog behaves entirely by instinct. Our intellectuals in the journalistic world in India are not free because they are driven primarily by ideology. You know, sometimes you're shocked at how stupid people can be, people even in the public field, right? Because they're not seeing things which are there so clearly to be seen, because what they have are these ideological blinkers. You know, you belong to a certain ideology, you would only say what you think others want to hear, because otherwise you would be excommunicated from the in-group. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
So what you realize ultimately is that most people live their lives like Pashu, in which they have no agency or freedom. And if one could step back and be connected to the Shiva within you, that's when you become Swatantra. That's when Swatantriya or freedom becomes accessible to you. And then you can do all kinds of wonderful things, all kinds of siddhis in the term that's used by Patanjali in his third chapter called Vibhutipad. All kinds of siddhis become available to you almost spontaneously. Because what is siddhi? Siddhi is just an ability to see things that others are not seeing. You know, as a creative person, as a filmmaker,
yeah,
as an artist, as a painter, as a musician, once that creative thing has been done, then it becomes so obvious. And then you wonder, why didn't somebody else see it, right? As an artist, you make a painting. After the painting is in front of you, well, now you can also copy it. But why did that painter make that painting, or that musician do that composition, which at that moment was entirely novel? So that's because people do not have the capacity to step out of the prison of their minds. Mind is also a prison, and normally, and that's where yoga or sadhana or true education, if one didn't want to use Sanskrit terms for it, true education is learning how to become free, how to access the creativity that lies within each one of us.
Sure, sir. So in one of the one of your articles, you've mentioned that the individual who wishes to be creative must become a yogi. And you've also sort of mentioned is accessing the source. So, so are there any techniques to do that, to enhance the creativity? And of course, how can consciousness come into play?
There can be so many different ways. Well, sometimes how you do it is that you, firstly, you go to school or college and they teach you some basic stuff of being disciplined, right? Basically, that's all there is to what you go to school and college for, and for socializing and for learning how to navigate your way through different situations.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, well, you need a mentor. And the mentor teaches you through example and through feedback, hey, this is what you should be doing, and perhaps helping you look at things. And you probably know that those things exist, but you have been too fearful. You know, sometimes everybody has that spark of truth within them, but they are fearful of holding on. And what they then do is they only parrot what they have heard on television or on radio or some book, and then they only repeat that because they lack that inner faith, Atma Vishwas. They lack that Atma Vishwas. And so really getting in touch with that creative you, within you, is to first of all have faith in yourself, have Shraddha, or faith in yourself, and have that Atmavishwas and dream big and say, yeah, I want to do this, and go to the very top people in your field and say that this is what I want to do and speak as an equal. So long as you are afraid and you are feeling intimidated, you are not giving an expression to that free self within you, that free core self within you, who knows as much as anybody else, because that free self within you is the same consciousness that somebody else, the great artist that you look up to, also has the same self within. So once you are able to communicate that faith in yourself, others will also sense it. And then things will change by themselves.
Sure. So ways to communicate that to yourself is, you know, some of the techniques that we need to do as creators, you know, like maybe yoga, like dhyan, the meditations, connecting to a guru, like you mentioned, a mentor whom you can look up to, and things like that.
Right, right. And it could be different ways for different people. It could also be sort of self-discipline. You know, it's very easy to do something, or just what in Mumbai Hindi is called time pass. Right? You just want to, okay, let's watch this movie. Hey, or let's just go and why don't we spend some time here or there, right? So you're basically, most people are running away from themselves most of the time.
Sure.
And if they are running away from themselves, they don't have the time to discover all the wonderful capacities that they have within them. You know, there's an interesting story on this. There was this wise man, and he was on his deathbed, and his sons came to him, and he said, sons, I'm going to die now, but here is this jacket, or coat, let's call it. I'm going to give one to each one of you. And then he died. Now these sons were sad. They went to their homes, and then they, this jacket was in a packing. So they took the thing off, and then they discovered an old coat, old jacket, let's say, each one of them. And one of the sons was very upset. He says, what was wrong with my dad? He was probably senile, and he's given me an old coat. What good is it? And he just threw it in the trash can. The other son said, well, why did my father give me this tattered coat? So let me see. He felt around and touched it here and there. And then he found something sticking. And when he explored some further, he discovered that these are all jewels which had been stitched into the coat. And then he took them out, and of course he became very wealthy. So this is what culture is. These are, you know, you say, hey, it's my past. What is this superstition, or what are my parents doing, and what are these old people doing? How this is crazy. I hate it all. I want to be modern, and so on, like that's like the first son. But if you really explore, within the culture are these wondrous jewels, which if you knew how to handle, give you tremendous power and make accessible to you things you didn't know existed. And in fact, this is the current crisis of India. You might ask, well, you look at the greatest creative people in the West in the past 200-300 years. Many of them have praised the Vedas, the Upanishads. You know, you look at Schopenhauer, you look at Emerson, you look at Thoreau, you look at Schrodinger, you look at Heisenberg, you look at, you know, artists, painters, musicians. They all praised India. But then Indians wonder, if India is such a great place, why is India such a mess? Why does India have so much poverty, this and that? I must reject it all. I must copy how Westerners do things and so on. And there are some wonderful things about the West as well. I'm not saying that you've got to pick one over the other. But India truly has elements to it which no other culture has. India is the only civilizational area or culture which looked not only at the outer world and talked about the outer sciences, which are the Apara Vidya, and it had no quarrel with it, embraces all of the outer sciences, but also had a whole framework devoted to Paravidya, which is the science of consciousness. In fact, the Veda proclaims that what the Veda is all about is Paravidya. It's about Atmavidya. It's about the science of consciousness. So this is the reason why Indian thought is so powerful, is so found or seen as being attractive in the West. Mm-hmm. By the greatest creative people, because they say that, look, this is, and it's not about this prophet or that prophet or doing things this way or that way or, you know, washing your face one way or the other way. It's about the deepest mystery there is, namely, what is it, who is it that we are, what is the meaning of life, what is the nature of reality. And certainly one element of the nature of reality is consciousness. And yes, consciousness changes everything. And therefore, if you are interested in creativity, you want to go outside of the box and you want to discover, you want to be the greatest musician or greatest filmmaker or writer or scientist, well, you must access elements of your own self which were not accessible to you in your normal mind operations, right?
Yes.
And so that can only be done through this, which is the reason why everybody outside of India, perhaps, because in India Vedas are not fashionable. In fact, people, I believe, from what I hear, look down on Indian wisdom. But outside of India, these things are considered world-changing, especially now as the world is facing this huge crisis. Mm-hmm. Where old ways of doing things will not be realistic anymore, where machines will replace people in most jobs. So the question of who you are will become more important than ever before. Mm-hmm. So I see Vedic ideas, Vedanta, yoga already has done that in many parts of the world. All of these things as the vehicles of the next great change taking place in the world.
Mm-hmm. So you also mentioned about Tantra in one of your papers and the structure of consciousness.
Right.
Anything you would like to add?
What is Tantra? Okay, one of the previous questions you asked me was the nature of consciousness, right?
Hmm.
Or what is mind? You can let's say you step back, you want to visualize, who am I?
Hmm.
And if you ask yourself that question, you would say, well, I was born in this family, then I went to school here or there, and these are my relatives, my parents, and these are the experience or memories that I have.
Hmm.
And then I generally believe in people, so I'm trusting, I'm open. You know, there's some people are closed, some people are open. So this is how you define yourself. But then you would ask yourself, where is this judgment being made? Where are these memories stored? And how are these memories interlaid with each other? And why do I sometimes have more confidence than some other times, right? These are kinds of questions that you might ask yourself. And then you might say, well, if I see all this in some kind of an amorphous way. I don't know where exactly I am, somewhere inside my head, right?
Yes.
And these memories are somewhere inside my head. Is there some way these memories are organized within me? And then I also have an emotional self. I also am interested maybe, you know, in interacting with others, and social self, or I also have a biological self. I also, maybe I have a spouse or a boyfriend or girlfriend, this or that, and I have certain unique emotions associated with that. Can I get into my head and see if I were to call my head as some kind of a building, what kind of a structure does this building have? How many rooms does it have? What kind of other things does it have? That is what Tantra is. Tantra is the very structure of your consciousness. And investigating the structure of consciousness, and there are many yogic disciplines which do it, or Tantra does it. Now that's called, for example, Kundalini Yoga is one of them.
Yes.
And there are many other yogas as well. And some of them are very scary, because as you uncover your own self, you come face to face with things that you may not have the techniques to deal with at that moment in time. Or what you might also do if you're journey is incomplete, you come by some siddhis or you come by some insights, and then you might want to use them to dominate other people, as some half-baked gurus do.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Because you're not gone all the way, and now you know that you have some powers, and you're also happy in your powers. So you want to dominate some other people, right?
Yes.
And there could be various things happening. But really, so Tantra is a kind of a path which has, where you need a mentor to guide you, but ultimately true yoga does go through an uncovering of yourself. So everybody must do this, including Shankaracharya. The Adi Shankara, for example, he also wrote a book on Saundarya Lahari. Now, a lot of the Tantra is investigation of the Devi or the goddess, because your whole energy system is the goddess, Prakriti, because that's your Prakriti, that's nature, right?
Yes.
So, in fact, all of Kashmir Shaivism is a part of Tantra. All the practices are Tantra. Wherever you investigate consciousness, that is a part of Tantra. Because normally, you know, look at Western psychology. Western psychology does not investigate consciousness. It says, hey, this is you, and these are your self. These are your drives. Now you do such and such, you can do such and such stuff. Or you can satisfy your drives this and that way. Doesn't ask who that self is and why are the drives of a certain kind. Now what yoga and Tantra do is to address those questions themselves.
So did Ramanuj, coming back to the first question, so Ramanuj, you mentioned he was able to, solve a lot of problems just in his dreams. There was no context to a lot of things that he created, how he created. Nobody knew the formulas and everything else. So did he manage to access that source of creation that we have been talking about for a creative person?
Well, everybody accesses it one way or the other, that creative self that you have. Sometimes you access it in delight. You know, you're walking on the beach and there's sunrise or sunset and there's, you know, a great joy that passes through you. Or in relationship. Or Schrodinger used the phrase that when you look into the eyes of your lover, you know, and you let go of who you are, at that moment, you're not yourself. Right? So there are different emotional ways of looking at it. But I can speak of one of my personal experiences, which may be of interest to you. One of the discoveries that I made, this was about 27 years ago, was about the very structure of the Rig Veda. And what was happening was that I was reading the New Yorker magazine, and on the very last page of the New Yorker magazine, there was a one-page essay by the American novelist John Updike. And this specific essay was about how the size of the sun and the moon seen from the earth is about the same.
Yes, right?
It's about the same size of the disk, which is why you have eclipses. That's why one can occlude the other, right?
Yes.
So, as in sun eclipse, right? Solar eclipse.
Yes.
The moment I read it, there was a flash in my mind, and I knew that the size of the sun and the moon had something. I knew it intuitively. It had something to do with the very organization of the Rig Veda and the very framework of Indian architecture and all of that stuff. You know, Indian ritual, yoga, and all of that stuff. So I rushed into my library and I opened my Rig Veda, etc. And in just a few hours, I was able to show that the Vedic rishis knew that the sun and the moon are 108 times their diameter away from the earth. And this is the reason why the Japamala has 108 beads, Bharatanatyam has 108 karanas, which are dance poses, and you have 108 tirthsthans, because what the Vedic rishis were trying to tell the world, that just as the outer sun is 108 units away, units meaning the diameter, away from earth, the inner sun, which is your Atma, is symbolically 108 steps away from your mind. So if you do dhyan, or if you do your sadhana, you do you are doing your japamala, you are doing 108 steps, so to speak, or 108 names of the god, 108 names of the goddess, right? This is all beautiful. It came out spontaneously. And then I wrote many papers on it. I wrote many books. And you, if you go to amazon.in, you'll see some of those books and so on. And many, many articles. You have that list on Twitter, for example.
Yeah.
And it all came spontaneously. In fact, in my scientific research as well, you know, if you learn how to let go, because normally we are closed. We, you know, if we say our mind is a house, we have shut all our windows. If you learn, and that's where some learning or yogic discipline comes in, you learn how to open those windows, that flash of light can come in and it can change you.
And 1 hour aapka maine le liya abhi to.
Wonderful.
Theek hai sir.
Aashirwad to you.
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you so much. That's it, guys. So the consciousness part is actually which I have been thinking about a lot since the past couple of months, plays a huge role in creativity. And I hope all of you and all of us can dig deeper into it. This is just the starting point of digging into the consciousness, and we hope to get more people who can enable this knowledge to us. So that's it, folks, for this episode. If you have any suggestions, if you want to talk to us, if you want to find me, you know where to find me. It's the WhatsApp number. You can also find me on LinkedIn, and you can find us on our Twitter and Instagram handle, which is newly and freshly brewed with the name Metaphysical Lab. And I'm going to end this with a very short poem by Mary Oliver, one of my favorite poets. And she says, instructions for living a life, which is pay attention, be astonished, and tell about it.